Please take a seat. Good morning, and glad to see so many of us here again as we go back into the book of 1 Kings and continue our journey with Elijah. So if you've got that open there on page 360, just as Sandra read it for us, 1 Kings chapter 19. Your perception is your reality. So said William James, the man who is known as the father of American psychology. Your perception, how you see and feel and understand things to be, that is your reality. We live in an increasingly psychological era. Especially here in the Western world. The kind of ideas that William James was first talking about over 100 years ago, which at the time were considered fairly revolutionary, are now absolutely commonplace. The idea that how we see the world and how we see ourselves is not merely a reflection or perspective of reality, it is the source of reality. That the subjective view is every bit as true as the objective one. It's what's given rise to increasingly common phrases like speak your truth, or change your thoughts, change your world. Maybe it'll help to have an example of how this works out in practice. I think the clearest example is probably some of the discussions that there have been recently around the idea of gender. Now, this isn't the focus of this message at all, but it may just help illustrate the issue. It would, for centuries, have been seen as absurd to suggest that someone born as a male in a male physical body could be anything other than a male. But, of course, today, that idea would be very strongly challenged. Many people would say, no, just because somebody is physically biologically male or female doesn't mean that's the reality. It doesn't mean that's what they actually are. So what's changed? Well, what's changed is where reality is seen to be grounded. Where do we find reality? No longer is it purely in the objective, in the external, in the physical. No, now for many people it's in the subjective. It's in the perception of the individual. Who they see or feel themselves to be, that is who they really are. Now, why on earth am I talking about this? Well, because I think a key issue that we find as we read 1 Kings chapter 19 is that of perception and reality. If you like, it's the question of who can see what is true and real. Because there are two perspectives, two points of view that we find here, Elijah's and God's. And those two are very different. And seeing the difference will, I think, be both instructive and inspiring for us, as we're helped, I hope, to see that God's view of things is more true, is more right, is more hopeful, and more real than ours. I hope today that Kings might persuade us, in fact, that our perception is not our reality. That our truth is not the truth, and that is an enormous relief. I hope that we'll leave here today perceiving more clearly, because we see that we don't see clearly all the time, and therefore instead we seek to see as God sees. And I hope therefore that we'll leave here praising more keenly, because what God sees is glorious. God sees better than we do. That's where we're going this morning. So let's wade in, shall we? Last week we looked at chapter 18, and things in chapter 18 were going spectacularly well, it seemed. God had just demonstrated his lordship over creation, his utter dominance over Baal, by sending fire down upon the sacrifice at Carmel, and then sending rain upon the land. The people's hearts on the mountain were being turned back to God. The Lord, Yahweh, he is God. The Lord, he is God, they cried. Elijah was the man of the moment, God's messenger and mouthpiece, taunting the false prophets, tearing down the false gods, tucking his cloak into his belt, and outrunning Ahab in his chariot all the way to Jezreel. But from the triumph of chapter 18, we move very swiftly to the disaster of chapter 19. From delight at Mount Carmel to absolute despair at Mount Horeb. Why? Well, have a look down at verses 1 and 2. Now Ahab told Jezebel everything Elijah had done, and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. So Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah to say, "May the gods deal with me, be it ever so severely, if by this time tomorrow I do not make your life like that of one of them." Sometimes something happens which is absolutely momentous, and you think, wow, this is just going to change everything. Take maybe the riots at the Capitol building in Washington over in America earlier this year. I guess we all saw the pictures of those back in January. Extraordinary, awful. And that kind of event, well, I think we watch on, don't we? And we think this must have a massive, seismic implications. The storming of the Capitol, of course, happened in the aftermath of the presidential election, won by Joe Biden and lost by Donald Trump. And, of course, Trump had many, many supporters in the election. It was quite close. But watching those disconcerting events unfold, you think, but now, I mean, after this, you know, incited by Trump, we're watching armed thugs with fur headdresses on roaming the Capitol building. Elected representatives are cowering in bunkers as they sought to ratify the result of a democratic election. I mean, surely after this, it's over. Surely Trump is finished. Polls currently suggest that if the choice at the 2024 presidential election was once again between Joe Biden and Donald Trump would win. That momentous event seems to have made little or no difference. On Mount Carmel, Yahweh had decisively and undisputably shown himself to be the true and living God. No one who was there could argue with the smouldering evidence of the soaking sacrifice. And Ahab, he was there. He knew. And we're told in verse 1 of chapter 19, he went to tell Jezebel. And so surely now, after that, the tide will turn. But there is none of that at all, is there? Just look down at verse 2 again. Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah to say, "May the gods deal with me." Jezebel's gods have been totally discredited and debunked, but she is completely unmoved. Instead, the episode at Carmel has just stoked her fire, and so she sends a message to Elijah to say, "I am coming for you." We've already been told earlier in chapter 18 that Jezebel has no difficulty, no moral compunction with slaughtering the prophets of Yahweh. And so, beginning of verse 3, Elijah was afraid and ran for his life. Now let's just pause here, because there's a footnote on that verse. If you're following it in the church Bibles, after the word afraid there, you can see the little number, the little letter A. We get there occasionally in our Bibles where there's a question about the right way to translate something. And if you look at the bottom of the column there, you can see the alternative. It might be that Elijah was afraid and ran for his life, or it might be that Elijah saw and ran for his life. Now, I won't bore you with why, but I think it's more likely that he saw is the better way to translate it. Elijah sees that what has happened at Mount Carmel has not in fact changed everything. He sees that the end of the drought and God's gracious sending of the rains has not softened Jezebel's heart. He sees that a national turning back to God is not what happens next. And if not now, it looks, from what Elijah can see, absolutely hopeless. And what he sees, how things look to Elijah, Elijah's perception, that is what dominates his mood and his actions in this chapter. Pick it up again. Elijah was afraid, or Elijah saw and ran for his life. When he came to Beersheba in Judah, he left his servant there while he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness. He came to a broom brush, sat down under it, and prayed that he might die. "I have had enough, Lord," he said. "Take my life. I am no better than my ancestors." Then he lay down under the bush and fell asleep. It is bleak. Out in the wilderness, where the people had wandered, we find Elijah alone and in bits. He wants to die. He has fled death at the hands of Jezebel, but not because he is mad keen on living. Some people think this shows a lack of faith on Elijah's part, but I must say I'm not at all convinced by that. In fact, I think we ought to feel deeply sympathetic towards him. He cares deeply about God's honour, and God is dishonoured in Israel. It is not beholden upon God's prophet, or indeed God's people, to always be full of the joys of spring. Sometimes it's right to be downhearted and depressed. Sometimes we can't be anything other. The Bible teaches us that lament is a perfectly legitimate heart language for the believer. Elijah had been by the brook, he'd been in the widow's home, he'd been atop Mount Carmel, but now he is in the wilderness. Maybe that some of us find ourselves there today. Maybe what you need to hear this morning is that your sorrow is not sin. And in the depths of the wilderness, and at the end of himself, Elijah is met by God. And we sometimes sing a hymn here, "There is a hope," that includes the lovely line, "When the world has thrown me in its deepest pit, I find the Saviour there." And so it is here in 1 Kings 19. In verse 5, "He lay down under the bush and fell asleep. All at once an angel touched him and said, 'Get up and eat.' He looked around, and there by his head was some bread baked over hot coals and a jar of water. He ate and drank and then lay back down again." In the midst of his misery, God sustains Elijah. He provides for Elijah. As he'd done so before, he does here, food and drink. Elijah is given today his daily bread. And indeed more than that, as we read on in verses 7 and 8, we find that God gives Elijah the fuel to keep him going on his journey. A journey that echoes the wilderness wanderings of the Israelites and takes him back to the scene of their most dramatic encounter with God. Because Elijah is headed to Horeb, we're told there in verse 8. Horeb is the name of the mountain range which contains Mount Sinai, or as verse 8 here calls it, the mountain of God. It was here that God had appeared to the Israelites in fire and smoke and lightning. It was here that he'd handed down to Moses the commandments. It is here that he had passed by. It's exactly the same phrase, actually, that we find in verse 11. The Lord is about to pass by. It's here that he had passed by so that Moses could catch the tiniest glimpse of his glory. A few weeks ago, James was talking to us in 2 Corinthians about the shining face of Moses after he'd seen the glory of God. Well, he got that here at Horeb. As we continue our studies in Exodus at midweek in the new year, we'll be coming here again. And verse 9 tells us that Elijah, when he gets there, went into a cave. Actually, it is the cave. Quite possibly the very same cleft in the rock that Moses had sheltered in. In his anguish, Elijah is to have an audience with God. Now, as we come to these next few verses up on the mountain, from where the heading is there, the Lord appears to Elijah, I just want us to note the structure. Because I think that will help us as we try and make sense of what is happening here. Because these are, I think, relatively famous verses. Some of us may know them well. Some of us may hold them quite dear. But they're not necessarily the most straightforward. So let's just take a moment and step back together. Because you may well have noticed, as Sanja read them for us, that twice Elijah is asked exactly the same question. In verse 9 and in verse 13. What are you doing here, Elijah? And each time, Elijah's answer to that question is exactly the same. In fact, verses from halfway through verse 9 and verse 10, and from halfway through verse 13 and verse 14, they are exactly, word for word, cut and paste, the same. So we notice that we have this repeated question and answer. And in between that, in verses 11 and 13, we have the appearance, or at least the presence, of the Lord in some form. Because, of course, we're told much more about where the Lord isn't in those verses than where he is. There are three supernatural occurrences in verses 11 and 12. A great wind, kind of tornado, it seems, that battered the mountain and shattered the rocks. Then the earthquake. And following the earthquake, a fire. We might imagine the footage from the news of the wildfires in California or Greece or Australia that we've seen in the past couple of years. It is an extraordinary display of power. These are all natural phenomena, but the way in which they process here makes clear that this is a supernatural display of power. Not unlike that the Israelites witnessed on Sinai, and yet three times we're told the Lord was not in this. Not in the wind, not in the earthquake, not in the fire. And then from halfway through verse 12, and after the fire came a gentle whisper. When Elijah heard it, he pulled his cloak over his face and went out and stood at the mouth of the cave. The gentle whisper, or as you may know it from the King James, the still small voice. It's a very unusual phrase. in the original. It's very tricky to translate. Maybe Simon and Garfunkel, those famed theologians, got close. It is the sound of silence. A quiet, so quiet, it's almost audible. We're not told explicitly that God is in the whisper, although Elijah's response to it in covering his face might imply that he senses something of God's presence at that point. But what we are shown is the impact that the whisper has on Elijah. Remember the structure that we noticed? This repeated question and answer that frames this kind of remarkable sequence of events on the mountain. Well, immediately after the whisper, halfway through verse 13, then a voice said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He replied, "I've been very zealous for the Lord God Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenant, torn down your altars, and put your prophets to death with the sword. I am the only one left, and now they're trying to kill me too." This encounter with God on the mountain, and whatever the still small voice is, it has absolutely no impact on Elijah's outlook whatsoever. The question, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" is not, I don't think, judgmental. It's not implying that he's in the wrong place. Rather, it's giving him the opportunity to open up, to share with God how things look to him. What has he seen that has caused him to flee the land and head into the wilderness? What is the spur that has ended him up here? That is what Elijah describes, the hopelessness of the cause from where he stands, from what he sees. Maybe Elijah imagines that at Horeb he'll receive a great supernatural revelation. He'll receive a great vision which will change everything for him. Maybe he thinks there'll be another Carmel moment coming. This will be a kind of second Sinai. But the point is made, in the way the thing is structured, I think, explicitly and repeatedly, that is not the case. God isn't in the wind. He isn't in the earthquake. He isn't in the fire. Often, indeed typically, God isn't revealed in the supernatural or the extraordinary. The events at Carmel for Elijah were the exception and not the usual rule. Just as Moses' encounter at Sinai was for him. That is not what Elijah gets here. In fact, he gets silence. Bill Dumbrell was an Old Testament professor for many years at Moore College in Sydney, Australia, and he summed it up memorably like this. I heard this in a sermon a few years ago, and it's always absolutely stuck with me. Dumbrell was asked, "What is the message of the still small voice? What is the message of the gentle whisper on the mountain?" And he replied, "No new message." That is what Elijah gets on the mountain. No new message. And so it is that Elijah's view is utterly unchanged by the encounter. His answer before and his answer after is exactly the same. Things look terribly bleak from Elijah's perspective. But Elijah's perspective isn't the one that really matters. His perception is not the reality. We might say that Elijah here speaks his truth, but it's not the truth. It's not the whole story. Because God sees and knows better. His is the real and perfect perspective. And so what Elijah needs is to see as he sees. And so have a look down at verse 15. Elijah, having answered again in the exact same way, the Lord said to him, "Go back the way you came and go to the desert of Damascus. When you get there, anoint Hazael king over Aram, and also anoint Jehu son of Nimshi king over Israel, and anoint Elisha son of Shaphat from Abel-Meholah to succeed you as prophet. Jehu will put to death any who escape the sword of Hazael, and Elisha will put to death any who escape the sword of Jehu. Yet I reserve 7,000 in Israel, all whose knees have not bowed down to Baal and whose mouths have not kissed him." The whisper spoke nothing to Elijah, but now he hears the voice of God speak clearly, and the message begins, "Go back." I expect that was a heart-sinking moment for Elijah. That probably wasn't what he wanted to hear. He wanted to hear, I expect, "Okay, Elijah, change of plan. I've got a nice little place set up for you on the coast. It's quiet, comfortable. You can stay and while away the years there, because it's all got a bit out of hand in Israel, hasn't it?" Elijah was probably like the school child who develops a sore tummy when it's time to put their shoes on in the morning. And the parent says, "Look at me. Just check your temperature. No, you feel fine. Open your mouth. Let me have a look. Okay, well, be brave. Get in the car." God says to Elijah, "Go back." There's no new message, no change of plan. There's no replacement, Elijah. I've still got work for you to do. Go back. But whilst he doesn't go back with any new message, he does go back with new information. Because God tells Elijah what he is going to do, what he's going to do through the foreign king, Hazael, what he's going to do through a new king in Israel, Jehu, and what he's going to do through a new prophet, Elisha. And he's told in verse 18 that despite what Elijah sees, despite what Elijah no doubt genuinely feels, despite his, what people now I think would call his lived experience, twice he said to God, "I am the only one left. I am the only one left." But God has those who are his. Thousands of them, in fact. Here's what you need to know, Elijah. Here's what you need to see. All is not lost in Israel. God sees those who are his, and he knows what will happen next. What will happen next isn't a great supernatural, miraculous event. There's no repeat of Sinai. God lays out before Elijah, in one sense, the ordinary, everyday, natural course of events he's going to work through. He's going to bring his plans and purposes about through the political processes of the ancient Near East and through the work of his servants. Go back. This is an account which teaches us about perception and reality. Who can see? Who can see what's true and real? Elijah sees no cause for optimism, no way forward, no future hope. "Take my life. I am no better than my ancestors. I am the only one left. And now they're trying to kill me too." We aren't, I don't think, to criticize Elijah for his despair. I think we are to empathize with him. For how often to us do things look hopeless? How often do we fail to see a way forward? How often do we look at ourselves as individuals? How often do we look at ourselves as a church and feel totally outnumbered, thoroughly outmatched in the world? Another Christmas. Are we really going to invite? Are we really going to shove invitations through people's letterboxes again? Surely nobody wants to know. Do you feel like that? I know I often do. And the world increasingly tells us to look in for truth. But the Bible tells us to always look to the Lord. Thank God our perception is not the reality. We ought to have a healthy distrust of our own ability to discern what is true and what is possible based on our own feelings. Thank God that His plans trump our perspective. And God has given us His word, just as He graciously spoke to Elijah. So He has laid out for us the direction of travel. He will build His church. That is the destination in the end. And He will take His people home. For He knows those who are His. And so He calls us to go back. Go back. Not with any new message. Not with any supernatural sign. But with faith that God's promises are sure and certain, and that He sees the end from the beginning, and that what we cannot see, what we cannot know, we can leave to Him, knowing that God sees better than we do. Let's pray.